I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Let's set aside the better-known Deanne Arbus images of the circus sideshow characters, or the twins, or the nudists. Take her ordinary portraits of people on the streets of New York, matrons, domestic workers, seniors. Even they are slightly off, uncomfortable, and yet brilliantly exposed. There is something intensely personal in what Arbus captures with her camera lens. When she had her first exhibit back in 1967, Arts Magazine wrote that, quote, "The great humanity of Deanne Arbus's art is to sanctify the privacy which she seems at first to have violated."
I think there are things that nobody would see unless I photographed them.
In an interview with Studs Terkel taped 2 years before her death, Arbus talked about her photographs in an almost casual way.
When I was very gloomy, I thought that I could let somebody else photograph them. You know, just, you know, call some very good photographer up and say, why don't you photograph this or this? I just have never believed that photographs are very useful to anybody but me. I mean, my photographs. Except that I suppose I think it'd be nice to keep them, because I do think I have some slight corner on something about the quality of things.
Well, Arbus's slight corner on the quality of things is on display once again in a major traveling exhibit of her photos called Deanne Arbus Revelations. It's been 33 years since the artist took her own life, and a reconsideration of her work is in order. So we'd like you to join us on this hour. Is there an Arbus photograph that is stuck in your mind? The twins? The so-called Jewish giant? She claimed she was dignifying the circus character she shot. Others called it exploitation. Are we any closer to knowing how Deanne Arbus changed the way that we regard the photo portrait? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking today with Patricia Bosworth. She wrote the biography, Deanne Arbus. It has just been re-released in paperback with a new afterword. And Patricia's joining us from a studio in New York. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be there.
Patricia, you met Deanne when you were a very young model, and she was at that time still doing fashion photography. I'm wondering if that encounter made anything of a lasting impression on you.
Oh, very definitely, because she treated me so wonderfully. I was very shy, and I was not a very good model. And the first thing she said to me when I got to the studio was, oh, good, you don't look like a model. That's why we hired you, which, of course, relaxed me. And it was one of my first assignments, and we went out on location, and she and her husband, Alan, photographed me in front of a Greyhound bus. It was for a Greyhound bus ad. And the whole thing was thrilling for me. I was 17 years old, and I had never met really an artist before, because when I first met her, I hasten to add, she greeted me barefoot in her studio, and that, too, was something that I'd never seen before. The whole thing was very memorable to me.
And you stayed in touch after that as well, or you would encounter her and she would remember you.
Well, I modeled for her about 3 or 4 times. She also asked me to dinner. She was curious about me, as she was curious about everybody. And I was 17 and a child bride, as it were. I'd gotten married when I was very young, 17, and she had gotten married when she was a teenager. And that connected us, that bonded us in a way. She wanted to know how I was coping, which wasn't very well. And she asked me to dinner a couple of times. She could tell that I was confused and unhappy. I never forgot that. But then later on, after I became a writer, we would see each other sometimes on the street. We might have coffee. And she began telling me about the different kinds of photographs she was taking. She'd left fashion by that time.
Right. Deanne was regarded as one of her students as, and I think the words are in your biography, fabulously seductive. And it's one of the things that goes right through your biography of her, Patricia, how people are captivated or drawn to her. Have you ever figured out what it was that Deanne Arbus had that made people react to her in that way?
Well, she was totally and completely and sincerely and intensely interested in you. She focused her total concentration on you. She asked you sometimes very intimate questions, but you were drawn into this kind of seductive, wonderful personality that she had. You heard her voice. She was girlish and seemingly almost innocent, beguiling, funny, very informed about everything, but, as I say, enormously curious and interested and concerned about you. That's what got to me. She was concerned about me as a kid who'd just gotten married, you know, that kind of thing.
Tell me what it was like for you after all the years of, since you wrote the book, to go to Deanne Arbus Revelation in L.A. last year and see all those photographs and all that memorabilia in the new exhibit. What was it like for you?
Well, it was a very moving experience for me because, of course, I know the photographs. I know the images very well. When I was writing the book, I had Xeroxes of all the famous images on the wall, like the twins and the Jewish giant. But to see them up close, to see the beautiful prints that Neil Selkirk had made, to see the memorabilia, some of which I had already seen because Howard Nemiroff, her brother, who was a great poet, had lent me her early journals that she kept when she was a young girl at Fieldston. But to see all the other, the books, the cameras, the little photographs that she put up on her bulletin board to inspire her, it was very moving. It was her evolution, her way of her process, which you see close up in the exhibit with the library, with the studio, the cameras. It's very amazing, quite remarkable.
I mentioned, and you have mentioned, one photograph that people often refer to as a distinctive Arbus photograph. That's the one that she calls, and the title of it is A Jewish Giant at Home with His Parents in the Bronx, New York, 1970. And for people who may not be familiar with the kind of photographs that she took, I'm wondering, Patricia, if you can describe that one for us so people can create an image of it in their mind.
Well, it's a picture of Eddie Carmel, the Jewish giant, who she met in Times Square. He was in the Carnival sideshow. Gay Talese, actually, the writer, introduced him to her, and she became fascinated, I guess, by him as a kind of almost mythological-type character. She began to photograph him, I think, it took about 10 years before she got what she wanted. She didn't know quite what she wanted at first, but she got to know him and found out about his life and his dreams, how he really wanted to be a great actor and be in good movies, not in horror movies. And finally, he took her to his apartment, or the apartment where he lived with his parents, who were normal-sized people. And I guess it was then that she realized she wanted to photograph him with his parents. And she ultimately, because he was so tall, I think he was, I don't know, 10 feet tall or 9 feet
eight
tall.
8 foot 9, I
eight
think.
8 foot 9.
That's tall.
It's tall. She photographed him on a ladder. I mean, she had to stand on a ladder to photograph him the way she wanted to, which is she photographed him with his parents, and his mother in particular, looking up at him with a kind of almost horrified expression on her face. It's an unbelievable photograph, and she described it to Joseph Mitchell, the writer at The New Yorker, that she said, you know how sometimes a mother, when she's carrying a child, is concerned that she may bear a monster, and that's the expression I wanted to get on the mother's face. Oh, my God, no. And you see this in the photograph. You see her just looking up astonished at her son, at her gigantic son. And he's sort of looking down rather sadly at her. It's a wonderful photograph.
And talking about the way that Deanne's work ended up influencing other work years later, NPR Sound Portraits went back into the archives. You mentioned, Patricia, that Eddie had hoped to be something other than just a giant, to be an actor, and they got an audition tape and use that as part of a sound portrait. This is the voice of Eddie Carmel, the Jewish giant.
Our feature story in just a moment, but first, you know you haven't seen anything if you haven't seen a wash done with a new Lifetime Oxydol.
And of course, at the very end of the tape is that significantly more personal message. Again, the voice of Eddie Carmel.
This concludes my audition tape. And I want to sincerely thank you all for taking the time to listen. I hope you found the audition satisfactory and that you'll have an opening on your announcing staff. In any event, I would appreciate the return of the tape.
That from NPR Sound Portraits.
Oh, gosh.
Isn't that heartbreaking?
Yes, it is. It is.
Tell me,
many.
Patricia, why it was that Deanne Arbus, who photographed so many people in the kind of life that Eddie lived, why did she call them aristocrats?
Because she felt that they had gone through a kind of trauma as unique and abnormal, perhaps you could call them abnormal because they're abnormal physically or people, she felt they'd gone through their trauma already in life and that they had a kind of strange dignity about them, which she found very admirable.
And yet people were very critical of her at the time for taking their pictures and putting them up on the wall, saying that she was just exploiting whatever it was that made them different.
Well, I think she was an original artist, and I think it's very difficult to accept something original right away. I think now her work is accepted, but it wasn't accepted as completely as it is now 20 years ago. But it's always that way with something unique and original, I believe, in art anyway. Even think of Picasso. The same thing happened with him and with many of the other painters who were turned, you know, people rejected them early on in the early part of the 20th century.
Now, just a note to our listeners, if you go to our website at theconnection.org, you will find a link to the exhibit, which will allow you to get to an image of the Jewish giant, the one that we've been talking about, as well as some of the better-known Arbus images, the twins and the triplets and shots from the nudist camps where she would sometimes take her camera. We're interested in hearing from you if there is one that sticks in your mind from that time or whether or not you think these kinds of photographs in many ways did change the way that we either see the photographic portrait or the way that we see the people that she was taking pictures of, because she did work very hard at giving them a certain amount of dignity. Do you think she was successful at that? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. My guest this hour is Patricia Bosworth. We're talking about the photography of D.N. Arbus. Now, Patricia is the author of D.N. Arbus, A Biography. It's now out in paperback with a new afterword. She's also done biographies of Marlon Brando and Montgomery Clift and currently working on a biography of Jane Fonda. But let's focus on the photography of D.N. Arbus, who took her own life some 33 years ago. There was a major retrospective right after that, 1972, and there is a new one, which is just opened recently in New York. So we're talking a little bit about that and the life of the woman and how she may have impacted your understanding of portrait photography. 1-800-423-8255. We're going to go to Raleigh, North Carolina for our first call. Daniel's on the phone. Hi, Daniel.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there are a couple of things. One is an element as a photographer myself. I like how she has managed to capture a unique angle and perspective, and I think that's what makes a good photographer, is somebody who can take something that everybody sees and say, okay, well, look at it from this angle.
Right.
That having been said, what she's done, whether she was aware of what she was doing or not, by trying to put this put these kind of images into the minds of Americans and everything, is she kind of promoted diversity, which has been really accepted today. I mean, my generation, the age of the 20s and younger, is considered one of the most ethnically diverse and open generations. And I think that her work in showing, you know, as you say in the commercial for this show, you know, what you weren't supposed to look at, it kind of promoted diversity because now people are trying to stand out. Part of the American ideal is to stand out as much as you can today.
Right. What do you think, Patricia? Do you think this is diversity before we even use that word?
Well, very possibly, but, you know, her dream was, number one, to photograph everybody in the world. That was one of her goals. And also, in the beginning, she was afraid to photograph what she thought was forbidden. And I don't think any kind of subject is forbidden now, but in those days, there were certain taboos like, transvestites, maybe even some of the freaks that she photographed. She broke that barrier, I think.
If she was afraid, why did she do it?
Because she always wanted to conquer her fear.
Huh.
That was another one of the things that she wanted to do. She wanted to break through all of her fears. She liked to challenge herself.
Back to Daniel in Raleigh. I'm just wondering if her work makes it easier for you to do what you do today. Daniel, are you there? No, we lost him. 1-800-423-8255. Where are we next to? Newton, Massachusetts. Alan's on the line. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I want to say that I grew up in the same neighborhood next door to the Jewish Giants.
You've lost all your Bronx accent.
I know. I'm quite proud of that.
Do you remember him?
Yes, I do. I remember the first time my brother and I walked to the local candy store, and we walked in, and all we could see was a gigantic pair of feet, which was terrifying. But the other children in the neighborhood loved him, and he was not a freak. And one of the things that I've always been interested in is his, is Diane Arbus's photograph of him, because while physically he is such an unusual standout person, in the neighborhood he was as well, but you could immediately, even as a child, we got his humanity. He didn't, the photograph of him, although freaky, never impressed me in the same way that some of her other photographs did.
Do you see that kind of compassion through the lens of Arbus's camera, Ellen?
On this one, I do, and maybe it's because I actually knew this person, and so I have a very different feeling about it. The other ones of her photographs are harder for me to identify the humanity in them, but this one I can.
It's in some cases. Thanks for that, Ellen. It's in some cases, Patricia, that she almost didn't want a pretty photograph. She didn't want to take a picture of a little girl, or the twins, in a pose that was, that their parents would love, but something different.
That's right, but that's the way she was. She said, I always see something that nobody else can see, and in, you know, my camera captures that. I think it was mysterious. I don't think she knew quite why or how, but she did indeed capture something very different always. It was not conventional, in other words.
I wonder if I can ask you to read a paragraph from the book. There's a story that you tell when Emile D'Antonio takes Diane to Todd Browning, excuse me, film Freaks. Do you know the place that I'm talking about, Patricia?
Yes, of course. I'd be glad to read it. It's Dee took Diane to see Todd Browning's 1932 movie Freaks, which Dan Talbot was reviving at his New Yorker theater on the Upper West Side. She was enthralled because the freaks in the film were not imaginary monsters, but real. Midgets, pinheads, dwarfs had always excited, challenged, and terrified her because they defied so many conventions. Sometimes she thought her terror was linked to something deep in her subconscious. Gazing at the human skeleton or the bearded lady, she was reminded of a dark, unnatural, hidden self. As a little girl, she'd been forbidden to look at anything abnormal. The albino with his flat pink eyes, the hair-lipped baby, the woman swollen with fat from some mysterious glandular disease. Forbidden to look, Diane had stared all the more and developed an intense sympathy for any human oddity. Those creatures had had normal mothers, but they'd popped out of the womb altered by some strange force she couldn't understand.
Do you suppose, Patricia, her reaction to those people was based in part there's a suggestion of it there, a very privileged upbringing in New York City?
Well, very possibly. I mean, she, from the very beginning, she did not think that the reality she existed in when she was growing up in this pampered household with butlers and maids and nannies was the only reality. And she very early on went out. After school, she would go take the subway and go down to the Bowery and follow bums around. And it was for her another kind of reality that she really wanted to know and understand.
1-800-423-8255 as we take a look back at the photography of Diane Arbus and what she has changed in the art of portrait photography. Let's go to Bellingham, Massachusetts. Sharon's on the line. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
So tell me what you think.
I guess my first question is, what's the correct way to say her name? Is it Diane or Diane?
Well, I pronounce it Diane because her mother named her after the character in Seventh Heaven, which was a movie that was showing when Mrs. Nemiroff was pregnant with Diane. The character was named Diane, and that's why I pronounce it that way. I don't think it's essential to do it, but anyway.
So that's the correct thing. That's good to know. I'm actually art portrait photographer, and what's interesting to me is just the kind of discourse that is created both within her photographs and around them. For a lot of times, documentary portrait photography is about simply the subject, but because she did it at a time that it wasn't standard to do this, it creates discourse around it. Like,
it's funny in a way, though. I mean, I was saying to one of my colleagues here at the program, Sharon, that I end up spending more time looking at the upper class women in New York with the nets over their hair or the turbans or dancing in a ballroom. I'm more drawn to them because even they show me that something unusual that was in the eye or the mind of the photographer. Do you see that?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's as if when she photographs, it's not about them, but about their relationship or the way that they're interacting, and it's not her looking at a person and taking their image away from them, but this kind of something that is happening between them, like a consensual kind of something ritualistic almost, and it is about her, not her vision so much as her interaction with them and what she elicits from her subjects. And the other question that I have.
Let me just hang on half a sec there. I just want to let Patricia in. Patricia, your thoughts about this kind of approach that she had.
Oh, absolutely. There is a definite and always a definite and very intense connection between photographer and subject. I mean, she connected, and you see her. You see the subjects reacting to her always in the photograph.
And yet she would put them in a setting which we would look at today, Patricia, and say is unflattering. You'd see a woman all done up with her jewelry and her hair just so, but perched on a couch with like piles of knickknacks and gigas all around her, which makes the whole thing very unflattering.
Well, I don't think Deanne thought that. I think she thought she was capturing this woman in the way she was,
right,
and as well as her surroundings.
Yeah, not to make a statement that it's flattering or not flattering, but it is what it is.
Just the portrait, the study of that particular person.
All right, Sharon, thanks for your call to Chapel Hill, North Carolina, for our next caller, and Jeff is with us. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having this program. I teach photography, and I show Deanne Arbus all the time, and there's been a lot of discussion about her taking pictures of freaks and midgets and transvestites, but she also took pictures of kind of normal people. I'm thinking of the teenage couple at the dance who win the dance, or the Puerto Rican woman walking down the street. And the way she puts them together, the freaks with kind of normal everyday people, I think turns us all into freaks. And in that sense, she's finding a common humanity.
There's a line in Patricia's book, Jeff, quoting Deanne, where she says, "I think all families are creepy in a way."
Yeah, right. And human bodies and human faces are all so different and so creepy in a way. And I find when I look through her books that I'm connected with these people in a way that's humanistic. I mean, that I feel like there's a picture of a girl sitting on a bed, and she doesn't have any clothes on the top. She has this very crazy afro.
Yeah. Can I ask you, Jeff, what the reaction of your students is to the Arbus photographs as inspiration or as something that they try to figure out? Because part of what we're talking about on the program is looking at her work today as opposed to, you know, in a 1972 context. Has it changed the way we look at photographs?
I think that her photographic language has kind of become adopted by professionals and students alike. And another caller said that, you know, it this diversity of humanity, which she kind of helped pioneer, is kind of a commonplace now.
And Patricia, like Jeff, Deanne also taught photography with Richard Avedon and in other settings. Was she making these points at the time, or was she asking people to just sort of look at the photographs and react?
Well, you know, she always gave these incredibly interesting assignments, which I think more than anything the students remember, the ones that I talked to. I remember she told me about Well, actually, Ava Rubenstein, who happens to, the cover of my book is Ava's photograph of her. But you know what the assignment was? Mm-hmm. Photograph somebody who you're afraid of, which is typical of her. But, you know, she really altered our sense of what is permissible in photography and extended the range of what can be called acceptable, you know, subject matter. That's part of what she did, I think.
And when you went back to see the exhibit after the sort of period between 72 and 2004 and saw some of the pictures, for example, the autopsy pictures or the pictures of her father on his deathbed or grandmother after she had died, was it easier to look at those?
Well, of course, I as her biographer, knew the stories behind, you know, why she photographed her father, why she photographed her grandmother. I don't even know whether I can repeat what I can. I don't think I can on the air. Maybe I could tell you later about what happened when she was photographing her father, because it was very disturbing. Yeah, I was disturbed by the photographs of her father, knowing the background of it. You know, they had a very complicated relationship.
She was also, though, I mean, she said at the time, I've just done this. I'm not sure that that's right. Or is that talking about her grandmother? I'm not sure if I've got the two confused.
No, photographing her father. Well, again, you know, he was doing things to himself in the bed, you know, and she photographed that. He was kind of in a dream state, almost hallucinating as he was dying, and she photographed that. I don't think she printed those photographs.
Right. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 to Buffalo, New York. And Robert has been patiently waiting on the phone. Robert, thanks for holding on.
Thank you. I'm the author of a book called Seizing the Light, A History of Photography. And in it, I tried to cover Deanne Arbus. And
had a little trouble getting the photos for the book, did you, Robert?
Yeah, just slightly. And I mean, I have, I think, a very favorable take about her position in photography. And I mean, I think that the pathos in her photographs are, you know, not due to the subjects, but due to our response as viewers.
Right.
And I had to submit my text to Deanne's eldest daughter, Dune, who didn't like what I had to say and offered suggestions about how my text could be rewritten. And when I refused to do that, I wasn't granted permission to include one of her photographs. So my question is basically to Patricia, how does she think that Dune Arbus's iron-fisted control over the estate has affected how critics and historians are able to evaluate Diane's work, especially in terms of defining what is normal?
Well, Dune Arbus is very controlling. She's definitely the keeper of the flame, and she has kept almost everybody at arm's length vis-a-vis trying to do scholarship on Arbus, including myself, because my book is unauthorized, so I understand exactly what you're talking about. She just believes that Arbus has to be defined in only one way, and that's the way she sees her. And in a sense, you know, other people see her that way too, and I think we'd all like to have the freedom to be able to go into the archives and use the scholarship that she has collected. But she's been adamant about it. She feels now, I think, I don't want to speak for her, that Revelations, this magnificent catalog that she worked on for 30 years, is really does express what she feels her mother was about as an artist. But I think she will still be very controlling about text.
All right, Connection listeners, is there an Arbus photograph that is stuck in your mind? If you want to review your memory, you can go to our website at theconnection.org, see a link to Deanne Arbus Revelations, which is the book that Patricia was just talking about, which does show some of the photographs, some of the more classic ones. And we're interested in hearing from you if she opened up your compassion in some way, your secret regard for characters, normal or bizarre, and did she raise or change the standard of portraiture? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. This hour, we're talking about the photography of Deanne Arbus. It is the subject of a major exhibit currently at the Met, Deanne Arbus Revelations. And Patricia Bosworth is with us from a studio in New York City. She's biographer and contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of Deanne Arbus, A Biography, which is now out in paperback with a new afterword. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Your past thoughts or exposure to or reflections on the photography of Deanne Arbus. Let's go to Burlington, Vermont, and Jane's on the line. Hi, Jane.
Hello. I am a minister, and I first encountered Arbus's photography when I was studying at Harvard Divinity School. There was an exhibit in the Worcester Art Museum, and I saw for the first time those photographs. And, of course, they were larger than life, and they made a profound impression on me. I really took them to heart, and I immediately went out and bought the book, the Aperture Monograph. And there is a quote in there of Arbus's, which speaks to this freaks issue. And she says, "Most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've already passed their test in life.
Mm-hmm.
They're aristocrats." That moved me so much, and I have to say it's influenced my sense of my ministry throughout the rest of my life. I think it has profound theological implications. She was asserting for these people their terrible right to be. She was witnessing them. She was inviting us to witness them. And at the same time, by including in her collection not just people whom we would label as freaks, but so-called normal people,
mm-hmm.
and presenting them in a similar way, she was inviting us to witness the fact, the reality, that we're all strange in some way. The strangeness, the inherent strangeness in each of us, also the specificity of each of us, what's funny or tragic or both about each of us. She captured the inherent suffering and loneliness in humanity. And she's saying, I believe, in her pictures, look, these people are us. We are them. I just found that so compelling.
We should probably say, just for the benefit of people who might be joining us, and Jane, your help with me on this, that you know, the use of the word freak, for example, was one that Deanne would use. It was the name of a film. She would talk about taking pictures of midgets. It's a term that's not necessarily politically correct now. People use the term dwarf. So that's her language.
That is her language, right. And if you want to continue on using her language, she's saying we are all freakish. We are all freaks. I think that's extremely significant. I think it's an invitation to look at humanity with all of its strangeness straight head on, and I think that's what she did in her portraits.
There's a story in Patricia's book, and I think it's a great time to hear Patricia read this because it's one of the stories which, for me, Jane, just sort of took me out of that, you know, here's a photographer taking a picture of someone who's standing in front of the photographer. Patricia, this is a story about Uncle Sam. What's his proper name? Maxwell Landers.
Yes, that's right.
Do you know have you got that page marked in your book?
Yes, I do. I will read it if you'd like me to.
Great.
All right. Deanne went to Washington, D.C. by train to attend the Kennedy inauguration with one of her favorite eccentrics, a tiny, gray-bearded, 80-year-old man, Maxwell Landers, who called himself Uncle Sam. Clad in a red, white, and blue Uncle Sam uniform, he'd originally worn the uniform when he was advertising an exterminator service, Uncle Sam talked compulsively about himself. "I am what I call a personality," he told her. "I've got the greatest laugh in the country. I am writing my life story, which will be similar to Mission to Moscow, which Dwight D. Eisenhower wrote. I have the voice of a man, woman, and child. I am a phenomenon. M-E-me. During the train ride, Deanne photographed Uncle Sam as he trudged up the aisles, proclaiming to the passengers how he planned to be the first man to shake the hand of Dwight D. Eisenhower when he was no longer president. She planned to photograph that moment, too, but when they reached the Capitol, Uncle Sam panicked. They missed the inauguration, and Deanne spent an entire night in Union Station calming him down. Periodically, he would do Shirley Temple imitations, and he repeated his name, Uncle Sam, to anyone who would listen. Near dawn, he was promising to bring the Liberty Bell back to New York. For a while, they slept fitfully on benches in the waiting room, and sometime the following morning, Deanne photographed Uncle Sam climbing imperiously up the 898 steps of the Washington Monument during a raging blizzard. Ultimately, she added Uncle Sam to her collection of eccentrics, along with the prince, the marked man, the junk collector, Polly Cora, and Stormé, the lady who appears to be a gentleman. She wrote a succinct little portrait to go with each picture after entitling the essay, The Full Circle. Who is it that can tell me who I am? Shakespeare. Pictures and text were accompanied by an eloquent introduction, also written by Deanne. Quote, there are five singular people who appear further out than we do, beckoned, not driven, invented by belief, each the author and hero of a real dream by which our own courage and cunning are tested and tried, so that we may wonder all over again what is veritable and inevitable and possible and what it is to become whoever we may be.
Well, Jane, I wanted Jane to hear that just because to me it puts real flesh on the image of this woman, not so much just as a photographer, but as a journalist, as someone who would then become quite, as you said at the very beginning, Patricia, intimately involved with the people that she worked with.
That's right.
I'm curious about one thing. Why did they let her in? Because of all the people who would have every reason to be suspicious or reluctant or of anyone coming near them with a camera, these people who had already been, you know, sat up on a stage as some spectacle at a circus sideshow, you'd think would say, no way, I'm not going to have anything to do with her. I don't care if you're Deanne Arbus or who you are. Why did they let her in?
Because she got them to trust her. She spent a great deal of time with them. She didn't photograph them right away. She sometimes spent weeks and months with them before she photographed them. She got to know them. She got to know what they were concerned about and interested in and cared about. And I think it was a matter of trust. And they really liked her. They enjoyed being with her.
1-800-423-8255. Let's go next to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Mary Beth's on the line. Hello, Mary Beth.
Hi. This is so interesting. I remember a Woody Allen movie. I think it was Stardust Memories. He boards a train. He looks at the train on the next siding, and he sees elegant, well-dressed people. It looks like something out of an F. Scott Fitzgerald kind of, you know, Great Gatsby novel. Mm-hmm. And he looks around his train, and everyone, I remember clearly thinking, everybody looks like someone Deanne Arbus photographed or would photograph, given a chance. And, you know, that addresses, I think, of course, Woody Allen was an adult when he made it, but when one is a teenager, you have that feeling that everybody else is cool and you're not, and everybody else looks great, and you don't. And kind of, I think Ms. Arbus got to kind of our Jungian subconscious or unconscious, all those archetypes that we feel like, uh-oh, we're one of the bad ones instead of one of the good ones.
What do you think, Patricia?
Well, you know, she was so literary. She, as her brother Howard Nemiroff said, she writes better than I do, and he was the poet laureate of the United States. She saw, but you know, she saw in many of these types mythological kinds of characters, people out of Alice in Wonderland. I mean, she romanticized these people too in a way, and I think that was that kind of brought the level of the photographs up, if you will.
I don't know, Mary Beth, if you remember the flashing image of the twins in Stanley Kubrick's film The Shining.
I certainly do.
But yeah, when you're telling me the Woody Allen story and I'm thinking of that, I'm wondering just how much has Arbus influenced the sort of cultural literature that we use in understanding images.
Mm-hmm. like a spaghetti sauce ad said years ago, it's in there. You know, I think she really got to us all, or we got to her.
What do you think, Patricia? Do you see the influence of Arbus in places that you know, aren't necessarily automatically noticed, but might show up in advertising or wherever we would see them?
Well, certainly that she certainly has influenced, I think, a lot of filmmakers. And as a matter of fact, she's going to be influencing the filmmaker who's going to be making my book into a movie. I don't know that you know this, that Nicole Kidman is going to be starring as Arbus in the movie version of my book. And the director is definitely, I think, thinking in those terms when he you know, thinking in Arbus-esque terms as he begins creating.
Well, you know,
this
both
movie.
Kidman and Arbus. How is that for casting? Is that, I mean, other than getting a name actor, which is not a bad thing, what do you think? Can she do Arbus?
I think she can do anything.
Yeah.
I think she's a wonderful actress, and she wants to do this because she wants to create a very distinctive character, and she certainly has in many of her other movies. So, but I didn't mean to get far afield about this. I do think Arbus has influenced fashion. She's in, believe it or not, fashion and advertising, movies, book covers, you name it.
I want to ask you about her suicide, 1971, not so much the event itself, but how that may have changed the way people regard the work that she does, because it's at one level, I would suspect, given a kind of cloud to the woman. She was, you know, always sad. She was always gloomy. She was always looking at the darker side of life. Is that a mistake to use her own suicide as a way of regarding what she'd done and how she worked?
Well, I think it kind of turned her into an instant legend, like Marilyn Monroe and Sylvia Plath, who also committed suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, she gained fame and was romanticized and more celebrated almost for living on the edge than for the photographs at first, but I really believe that she's recognized as one of the truly seminal photographers of the 20th century now. But right after her death, I think maybe there was a confusion. But in terms of why she committed suicide, she was very depressed. She couldn't take antidepressants. She was allergic to them. Her mother told me that if she had taken pills, she might not have committed suicide. She was always depressed from the time she was a little girl. The whole family was a depressive family.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. That's the number to join our conversation this hour about Deanne Arbus there. And just a reminder that if you're puzzling over the images that we're talking about, you haven't seen them, you can get a look at them. It's a little bit circuitous, but go to our website. We're at theconnection.org. There you can find a link to the new exhibit, which is currently traveling the country, recently opened at the Met in New York, Deanne Arbus Revelations. Patricia Bosworth is my guest this hour. We're talking about how we look back on her 33 years from her death. My name is Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. One of the things that comes up a lot in the book that I wanted to ask you about, Patricia, is her relationship with sex, because she's so passionate at one level, and yet she seems so casual about physical contact in another. I mean, she'd wade into an orgy and take pictures. There's the suggestion she'd do it either with or without her clothes on. And I'm wondering if you ever got to understand that part of her.
Well, it was certainly one of the most difficult parts of the book for me to write, in that I felt it was a very private part of her life. But oddly enough, everybody who I talked to, almost everybody, said you must write about her obsession with sex and her interest in sex. And so I did. It was a very difficult thing for me to do, in that, I thought it was private. But I think she had a mixture of feelings about sex, as everybody does.
Yeah.
On the one hand, she had believed totally in romantic love until her marriage broke up. Then she said she stopped believing in romantic love, but by the same token, she fell in love again with Marvin Israel, and I think loved him very much. I think she was an adventurer. I think she wanted to. She felt that she wanted to experience sex freely and openly. She was not a prude in any way, and I think that was the other thing that she wanted to do. I know it sounds confusing, but she really, I think she was ambivalent. Ambivalent, and yet, she on the one hand, she was talking obsessively about sex all the time, which she did to everybody. And on the other hand, she longed for a beautiful, complete romantic relationship, which included sex.
Speaking of ambivalent,
I know I'm not answering the question.
No, you
properly.
Are. You are. And because there's another question that I had set aside that I wanted to ask you, and that is the quote that I kind of resisted using in the program, in part because I don't really quite understand it. It's an Arbus quote, and it's probably the most often quoted, where she says, "A photograph is a secret about a secret. The more it tells you, the less you know." Because it seems like it's kind of backwards. She is telling us so much with her photographs. I'm not sure if she's just playing games with words there, or she really was in a, you know, also saying, don't believe what you see.
Well, also, you know, everything finally is a mystery. There is no answer totally. There's no total answer to anything. I mean, I go by Mark Twain's definition of a biography, for example, a biography of the clothes and buttons of a man and a woman. But the real story, all the thoughts of a man or a woman, you can only get the essence. I think that's what she was saying. You cannot possibly get everything. There's always a mystery. The more it tells you, the less you know. It's a conundrum. It's a, you know, maybe a contradiction. But that's what she was saying. Life is full of contradictions and endless questions. Don't try to analyze everything, which is what you've been trying to do all along here. You can't. This woman is a mystery because she's a great artist. And all art is a mystery. All great art is a mystery. You can't answer it. You cannot define it totally. There's no way.
And I will no longer try. I will take that as a perfect.
No, but I'm just telling
you. It's a lovely way to sort of put a coda on the woman, because the answer is you're quite right.
She's a mystery. There's no way I could have ever defined her totally.
Patricia, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the program.
Thank you.
Patricia Bosworth, contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of Deanne Arbus, A Biography. A special thanks to Sound Portraits for use of the audio that we heard a little bit earlier on the program, the Jewish Giant Audio. Our program is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fenollosa, Pamela Ferdinand, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.